Alrighty, we're going to pick it up at the First Regathering Modern Israel on session 31, page 216 in your notebook. Let's do a quick review. Last week we broke session 30 into two parts. Session 30A was a DVD from Against All Odds, A Warrior Named Kalahani, where we got a first-hand look at what was happening up on the Golan Heights in the 1973 war. As Avigdor Kalahani and his seven tanks tried to fend off the huge Syrian armada coming across the Golan Heights. And again, as you saw all that happened there, you have to think, how is it possible that Israel could have survived that attack without some kind of divine intervention? And Avigdor Kalahani became one of Israel's modern heroes. So that was quite a show. Then we took a break, and Session 30B was again from Against All Odds, Rescue at Entebbe. And again, we saw a first-hand account of all that happened in Entebbe, Uganda, when Palestinian terrorists hijacked that French airliner and were threatening to kill over 100 Israelis. And we saw interviews with the pilot who brought in the first C-130 to rescue the hostages, and also the interview with the lady who was one of the hostages herself. So again, you say, how could that rescue attempt succeed without the overriding hand of God? Just like in the book of Esther. You know, God is not mentioned in the book of Esther, and yet God preserves his people. Even in disobedience, he preserves his people. Well, that's what happened in Entebbe. You know, God was not visible outwardly, but he made sure everything came together so that rescue occurred. So application was to look for that in your own life. Look for the God things in your own life when he brings things together for you on your day-to-day basis. All righty, that brings us then to the bottom of page 216. And 1977, Likud comes to power. So amid the turmoil of contending parties, the 1977 electoral campaign gave every appearance of following earlier precedents of turning into a contest between three major blocks. The largest bloc was the labor-dominated alignment. The other end of the political spectrum was the conservative Likud Party under the leadership of Menachem Begin, page 217. Finally, there were the religious parties. Things are a little different today. The Knesset is broken up into even more parties. But in 1977, this is the three basic divisions of the political picture in Israel. Labor members such as Yigal Alon and Abba Eban favored a substantial Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank. You know, get out of the West Bank. Menachem Begin, on the other hand, perceived of an undivided land of Israel. In other words, take over the West Bank. When the votes were counted, Likud was found to have increased its Knesset representation from 39 to 43 seats. The National Religious Party had enlarged its delegation from 10 to 12, and Labor had lost one-third of its strength. Never before in Israel's history had there been such a shift away from the Labor Party. And that shift has continued. Likud is still the dominant party these days. All right, Anwar Sadat. The shift in Israel's political and economic course in 1977 was prefigured by a striking and no means dissimilar reorientation in Egypt. Now, three factors for this. Factor number one, Anwar al-Sadat orchestrated the change personally. With his reputation at new heights following the Yom Kippur War of October 73, the Egyptian president felt secure enough to embark on a far-reaching overhaul of Egyptian society, a liberalization in all fields. The new liberalization, of course, affected the economic field. Sadat wanted to introduce Western-style capitalism. And he knew that could only be achieved through peace. To foster his vision of national revival, Sadat made the calculated decision June 1975, to open the Suez Canal. Sadat insisted that economic viability could not be reconciled with the burden of maintaining on a perpetual war footing, keeping 700,000 men under arms. The successful crossing, military crossing, of the canal appeared to fortify the nation's desire for peace. With their honor restored, the Egyptian people found less humiliation in contemplating a new relationship with the enemy. Some key words in that sentence: honor and humiliation. Those are key aspects in the Arab outlook on life. You maintain your honor, and it's horrible to be humiliated. You do anything to avoid humiliation. Okay? So keep that in mind. It's true, of course, today. Sadat explained his approach succinctly in his autobiographical work, In Search of Identity. And if you're a history buff, the book In Search of Identity by Anwar al-Sadat is available on Amazon. So just go on Amazon.com and you can find it, his autobiography, In Search of Identity. So it must be fascinating. I have not read this book myself. All right, now, inside the book, you have a quote, bottom of page 217. Here's what he says. We had recovered our pride and self-confidence after the October 1973 battle, just as our armed forces did. We were no longer motivated by complexes, whether defeatist, inferiority ones, or those born out of suspicion and hate. This is why the opposing sides met soon after the battle dust had settled to talk matters over. And with the fighting over, we harbored nothing but respect for one another. Now that is another very typical Arab view of life. The Arabic community in the Middle East respects power. Power. Might makes right. And you do anything in your power to get what you want. And if you do, that's honorable. And if you don't, you're humiliated. So you try to avoid humiliation. So these are key words in understanding the Arab mindset of the Middle East. Humiliation, honor, and respect. So because the army battled tooth and nail against Israel, now they had respect for one another because they had equal power. Okay? Might makes right. Does that make sense? So now it's okay to negotiate with the enemy because negotiation is humiliating. You don't negotiate. You know, if you're weak, you negotiate. If you're strong, you take what you want. So now we have respect because we have two co-equal powers. They're willing to negotiate. Okay, does that make sense? That's the Arab mindset. All right, page 218. Now, the inauguration of a new administration in Washington added a unique momentum to the search for Middle East peace. So factor number two is that Jimmy Carter entered the White House in January 1977. Of course, here's a photograph of our president. We all remember Jimmy Carter, one way or another, I think. He was instrumental in a peace process that got started, but he is no longer any friend of Israel. He calls Israel an apartheid state. So he's really traveled off the deep end these days.
Well, he's a peanut farmer.
He's a peanut farmer, yeah. As he evaluated his future course, Sadat was presented with an unexpected opening by the Israelis. It happened that upon forming his cabinet, Menachem Begin had astonished his colleagues and the nation at large by his choice of foreign minister. And that's factor number three, Moshe Dayan. Upon assuming office, Begin shared an interest in a trade-off. What he had in mind was an Israeli free hand in Judea and Samaria. In other words, he wants a united Israel, one nation without any divisions, for a state of non-belligerency with Egypt, yet he wanted peace with Egypt. So Dayan, with his record as a dove in Sinai, creating peace, and as a hawk in the West Bank, taking over the West Bank, would be indispensable to Begin in selling the idea of such a trade-off, first to Egypt, then to Israel. So Begin began dispatching signals to Cairo of his willingness to strike a deal. So we'll give you Sinai, you give us the West Bank. That was basically the idea there, in the very crude, simplistic terms. Dayan ordered the draft of a possible Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. The paper was sent off to Washington for examination. U.S. endorsement was regarded as indispensable for leverage with the Arab enemy. As Dayan hoped, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and his advisors were impressed enough to request the president's personal intervention with the Egyptians. Carter agreed. September 10, 1977, the document was sent to Cairo, followed by a private letter from Carter to Sadat. The president asked Sadat to test Begin's sincerity. Now at that point, May 1977, General Yitzhak Hofi, director of the Mossad, that's Israel's CIA, uncovered information of a Libyan assassination plot against Sadat. Begin decided to convey the information to the Egyptians. "It may warm the atmosphere between us," he suggested. Morocco's King Hassan was regarded as a valuable conduit for the information. In June 1977, convinced that the moment for peace was ripe, Hassan was prepared to serve as an intermediary. He proved to be an effective one. Through the Moroccan ambassador in Cairo, the Egyptians were informed that Israel possessed vital security information. Inasmuch as the data could only be transmitted directly, the king arranged for a meeting in Casablanca between General Hofi and Egypt's Director of Military Intelligence, Lieutenant General Kamal Hassan Ali. Hassan Ali was stunned by the detailed evidence the Israeli brought to him, including names and addresses of the Palestinian assassins in Cairo. These are Palestinians. Acting on the information, the Egyptian secret police seized the conspirators with extensive incriminating documents and weapons, and Sadat was genuinely grateful. Page 219. Question. Egypt was not in control of the West Bank, but Israel was. But Egypt was making the Palestinian problem part of the issue. Okay, and so when we come to the peace treaty, you'll see that solving the Palestinian problem is part of the agreement. Okay.
How would they have the authority, though, to give it to Israel?
Well, they don't really have the authority to give to Israel, but what they want to do is work out some sort of an agreement where they will not be belligerent against Israel. If Israel begins to take over more and more of the West Bank, okay?
Were they just kind of self-appointed
representatives? They were the lead, yes. Egypt was the leader of the world, Arab world at this time, yeah. Where Egypt went, the rest of the Arab world would go, yeah. All right, page 219. The Egyptian president accordingly sent word through Morocco that he was prepared to listen to serious Israeli proposals. In November 9, 1977, Sadat announced that he was willing to go to the Israeli parliament and discuss Israeli withdrawal from Sinai. The impact of that statement was stunning. In Israel, Begin was astounded. He had anticipated private talks, you know, low-key stuff. But a public ceremonial visit by an Egyptian president to Jerusalem? That prospect seemed all but unimaginable. The Prime Minister was on state radio the next day, issuing an open invitation to Sadat to come to Israel. 5 days later, in a note communicated through the U.S. embassies in Tel Aviv and Cairo, Begin formally and officially invited the Egyptian leader to address the Knesset on November 20th. Now, you guys, Israel is accused these days of not wanting to make peace. But the point is, as soon as an Arab country extends its hand sincerely for peace, Israel is right there. They'll be right there every time, seeing what they can do. And that's a perfect example of it right here. Egypt extends their hand in peace, and what is it? Begin is right there. Let's do it. The Israelis want peace. Don't be fooled by the liberal media and any statements that say the Israelis do not want it. They do want it, you guys. Okay, Sadat accepted on the spot. In November 20th, 1977, Sadat faced the Knesset with a 40-minute address, and you have this picture on page 219 of the Egyptian president in the Knesset itself, speaking to the representatives of Israel. Quite an amazing change in position, and it's quite an historical moment. In his speech, Sadat offered Israel the inducement its people had waited 30 years to hear. Israel is now 30 years old. Bottom of the page. In all sincerity, I tell you that we welcome you among us with full security and safety. We used to reject you. We had our reasons and our fears, yes, but I declare to the whole world that we accept living with you in permanent peace based on justice. Today, through my visit to you, I ask you, why do we not stretch out our hands with faith and sincerity so that together we might remove all suspicion and fear, betrayal, and bad intentions? Now, those are a lot of good words, but words are cheap. And putting words into action is another story. Page 220. Upon his return, Sadat's reception in Cairo was tumultuous. Nearly a million people cheered him on his open-air journey from the airport. However, now we get down to reality. Initial discussions were agonizing for both sides, and soon Egypt and Israel were at an impasse. That brings us to 1978. It was the very lack of success that brought into play a critical procedural agreement between the Israelis and the Egyptians. Sadat and Begin consented to discuss their outstanding differences jointly with President Jimmy Carter at the presidential retreat of Camp David. It would take place at the urgent request of Jimmy Carter himself. He was aware that the two Middle Eastern governments were reaching a possibly irreconcilable standoff. The American president was determined that the momentum for peace between them would now have to be restored, if necessary, by exercising the fullest political influence of the most powerful country in the world. September 5, 1978, Sadat and Begin arrived at Camp David. And here, again, reality set in. Eventually, after hard and emotional negotiations, two agreements were hammered out. One was entitled A Framework for Peace in the Middle East. The other, A Framework for the Conclusion of a Peace Treaty Between Egypt and Israel. Now, the arrangements were good for both sides. The Egyptians were guaranteed return of all their land. The Israelis would gradually return all the Sinai to Egypt, and normalized relations between the two countries would gradually phase in as well. Three-stage negotiation framework for the Palestinian problem in all its aspects was outlined as well. See, there it is. See, the way Egypt goes, how Egypt deals with the Palestinians is how the rest of the Arab world would do it. The Camp David Accords represented an impressive diplomatic breakthrough for each of the participants. September 17, 1978, a televised ceremony of signing took place in the White House. And here's that photograph. You have that on page 220. On the left is Begin, then Carter, and then Sadat at this signing in the White House. Now, President Carter himself observed that a formal peace treaty between Egypt and Israel would be negotiated and completed within the next 3 months. So the road to peace seemed dramatically shorter. Now, Sadat was a hero when he arrived home. In late November, the 1978 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded jointly to Sadat and Begin. But a hair-raising road to peace still remained. The initial euphoria died away in Egypt, and serious opposition surfaced regarding the Camp David Accords. Bowing to pressure, Sadat altered his understanding of the agreement. And by the way, when we get to Abba Eban's DVD of this, Abba Eban will say, just the opposite. He will say there was pressure in Israel, and so Begin altered his understanding of the agreement. So there was pressure from both sides by the more conservative sections of the communities. By December, when the peace treaty was originally scheduled to be signed, the likelihood of peace appeared dim. So that brings us to 1979. In March 1979, President Carter, in an act of desperation, decided to travel personally to Egypt and Israel in an effort to achieve a final breakthrough. A hectic 5 days of negotiations in Cairo and Jerusalem concluded with a peace treaty. So on March 22, 1979, by a margin of 95-18, Israel's parliament voted to ratify the peace agreement. 4 days later, March 26, 1979, in a White House ceremony, Sadat and Begin placed their signatures on a formal treaty of peace between the two nations. And this picture, you have this picture on page 221. Remember, Egypt and Israel had only signed armistice agreements 30 years earlier, as had the rest of the Arab world. Technically, all the Arab nations and Israel were still in a state of war. And now the first formal, actual peace treaty has been signed. Big step forward in Middle East peace. Big changes in Egypt's attitude with Sadat there. Now, the document terminated the state of war between Israel and Egypt, and Israel undertook to withdraw all its armed forces from the Sinai. Egypt pledged itself to use Israel's evacuated airfields in the peninsula exclusively for civilian purposes. Each party agreed to respect the other's sovereignty, territorial integrity, political independence, and its right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries. And you know that has held now even till today. It's held for 30 years. We'll see how if it continues to hold, because there's some changes in the Egyptian government, but it's still holding. Each undertook to conduct normal diplomatic, economic, and cultural relations with each other and to remove all discriminatory barriers to the free movement of people and goods. All right, let's jump ahead now to 1981 and Iraq's nuclear reactor. In 1974, Saddam Hussein government in Iraq began making plans to go nuclear. And here he is. We're all familiar with this, sweetie, aren't we? Remember old Saddam Hussein? Saddam Hussein. Yep. The next Nebuchadnezzar. He saw himself as the next Nebuchadnezzar. Saddam Hussein set about promoting his own brand of pan-Arab socialism throughout the Middle East through subversion and terror. Those close to the man regarded him as the logical heir to Gamal Abd al-Nasser. Remember, he was the former president of Egypt and very anti-Israel. Excuse me?
A Jew-hater.
Yeah, oh yeah, Jew-hater, that's for sure. Saddam intended to widen his influence as Nasser never had by becoming the first Arab leader to command a nuclear arsenal. So he wanted to lead the Arab world. Iraq was able to rely on the cooperation from France. Sometimes I wonder where the French brains are. In 1978, misgivings were developing even within the French Foreign Ministry. The French contract with Iraq promised delivery not only of two nuclear plants, but of nuclear fuel enriched with uranium-235. The fuel was to be shipped in 6 installments of 13 kilos each, with the entire consignment to be delivered by 1981. It was sufficient uranium to manufacture 9 nuclear bombs. Page 222. What is France thinking? The Israelis decided to adopt vigorous countermeasures of their own. In April 1979, saboteurs broke into the warehouse near Toulon and blew up the casings for Iraq's first reactor. The components had been scheduled for shipment that week. New casings were delivered in autumn of 1979. The first installment of enriched uranium reached Iraq in June 1980. After 3 more shipments, the Iraqis would be able to irradiate through enough fuel from their reactor to produce weapons-grade plutonium. By mid-1980, the Saddam Hussein regime would be expected to possess a stockpile of at least 6 atomic bombs. One way or another, Saddam Hussein's nuclear program would have to be stopped. Does today sound like history repeating itself? Isn't it? IRAN, yeah, right. Take that Q off and put an N and you got the same thing. Menachem Begin desired an aerial bombardment of the Osirik reactor. The raid was set for June 7. Preparations began and continued through the winter and spring of 1981. June 7, 1981, at 4 p.m., 8 Israeli F-16s took off from their base. The planes were provided with extra fuel tanks and a special bomb racks that carried 2 2,000-pound MK-84 iron bombs. So this is the F-16 that carried out the bombing raid. This is the type of aircraft that carried out the actual bombing raid, the F-16. Here is, I believe this aircraft is no longer in operation. It's in a museum, I believe, in Israel, Air Museum. This is the IAF F-16A flown by Colonel Ilan Ramon. Remember Ilan Ramon? He died in the space shuttle accident. Israel's first astronaut died in the space shuttle accident. He was the eighth pilot. He was the eighth and last to drop its bombs into the reactor. So there's the aircraft that Ilan Ramon flew. Now, on the side of the aircraft, there's a mission insignias. So let's take a close-up look at that. And the insignia on the left, that's the mission insignia of attacking the Osiris reactor. You see it's a reactor there and a little symbolic bomb going into the reactor.
That's an American plane.
Yeah, this plane is created in America. That's right.
Bob.
Question.
My dad observed or watched that bombing of the reactor from the veranda of his villa south of Baghdad.
Your dad watched that, really?
He was one of 70 Americans.
That was close by, huh? Wow. That must have been quite a sight. Huh?
Yeah.
All right, once airborne, the F-16s moved into formation with an escort of six F-14 fighter interceptors. Now, this is the F-14. It's the swing-wing jet. Here we have the picture of one with its wings swept back for high-speed maneuverability, high-speed flying. And then those wings can crank out, that's the extended position, for low-speed maneuverability.
Latest version of the F-15 Eagle.
Yeah, so these were escorting the F-16s. The Israelis also readied an unknown number of other planes, including F-15s, equipped with oversized tanks to provide aerial refueling. And here's the F-15. This is the third type of aircraft used in this raid. And here's a couple of Israeli F-16s flying as well. So these were the type of aircraft that were used. Now, the trip would cover more than 1,000 miles to the target and back. The distance would stretch the F-16 range to its limit. Any deviation from the plan, any battle with enemy aircraft, would require additional fuel, and refueling would have to take place over Arab territory, not the place you want to refuel. So no room for error existed. The main force of eight F-16s and six F-15s, that's 14 planes, accordingly headed east across the Gulf of Aqaba and along the northern width of Saudi Arabia near the border with Jordan. Military intelligence had selected the route after identifying its occasional radar blind spots. The attack group flew in a tightly bunched formations to project the radar signature of a large commercial aircraft. Crossing Saudi and Jordanian airspace into Iraq, the plane sped past Baghdad to Tuwaita and approached low to avoid detection. One of the F-15s initially overflew the Osiris reactor to draw anti-aircraft fire. Meanwhile, the F-16s had swept up into the sky to allow the pilots to aim. With the setting sun behind them, they dived into the target, sending the bombs hurtling against the reactor's concrete and lead protective dome. The tactic had been refined during months of practice against a mock-up in the Sinai. The first bombs were fitted with delayed action fuses, allowing them to penetrate the dome before exploding and opening gaping holes in the side. The next bombs, can you believe this, you guys? The next bombs struck only moments later, finding the hole with stupefying accuracy. The second set of bombs went right through the opening, in the words of a French observer, and destroying the reactor inside. So your dad didn't realize what was going on there.
Saw a lot of smoke.
Yeah. One French technician was killed in the attack, and the Iraqi anti-aircraft fire spattered harmlessly, and all Israeli planes returned safely. Now, you have a map on page 223. This is the map on page 223, and we're going to look at the mission very quickly. Number one on the left, 1555, actually 1600 hours, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the aircraft take off from Etzion Air Base. Now look at number two, you guys. Flying across the Gulf of Aqaba, the aircraft fly directly over King Hussein's yacht. He was out in the Gulf of Aqaba enjoying a sail, and at least 14 Israeli warplanes at low level come directly over his yacht. Do you think he figured that something big was happening all of a sudden?
I think he ducked.
Yeah. Do you think he notified Baghdad? Well, apparently not.
This is Saddam Hussein.
No. This is King Hussein. This is King Hussein of Jordan. King Hussein of Jordan. Yes. So he knew something was up real early. Well, then the 14 aircraft fly across Saudi Arabia, and at 17:35, 8 F-16s strike the reactor, and with tremendous accuracy. And then point four, the aircraft return at high altitude and land at Etzion Air Base at 1900. They left at 1400. They returned at 1900, a five-hour operation, and it was all over. Everybody returned safely. All right, it's now time for your break. So we'll pick it up after the break on page 223 with the question, was the raid justified? So go ahead and take your break. All right, let's return then to the bombing of the Osirik reactor, and we'll continue with the question, was the raid justified? Page 223 at the top of the page. From all evidence, the Iraqis were indeed moving toward the production of atomic weaponry. Now, the airstrike's diplomatic fallout was far-reaching. President Reagan at first condoned and then criticized the attack, both in official statements and in the support of a UN Security Council resolution of condemnation. A scheduled shipment of F-16 aircraft to Israel was halted. Israel's violation of Saudi airspace multiplied Saudi appeals for effective radar protection. You guys, publicly the world screamed at Israel. Everybody complained, but privately they patted Israel on the back and said, thank you. And it's the same today. If Israel bombs the Iranian reactor, the world will scream. And then they'll turn to Israel and say, thank you. You know? If the air attack reaped criticism on the international scene, there was one area at least in which Begin achieved substantial success, and this was in Israel itself. Here, the news of the bombing evoked widespread admiration as a legitimate act of self-defense. The sheer audaciousness of the raid, no less than the brilliance of its execution, visibly enhanced the Prime Minister's political standing only days before the Knesset election. All right, page 224. Page 224 is entitled Israel's Withdrawal from the Sinai Completed. You have this map on page 224, and we'll take a look at the legend. The legend's in the upper left corner. You see the blue area on the screen. That's the Israeli territory before and after the Six-Day War. Light blue before, the dark blue is the areas Israel now controlled after the Six-Day War. Now, moving down the legend, the orange area is the Separation of Forces Agreement that was agreed upon in 1974. That is the no man's land between Syria and the Golan Heights that exists still today. Moving down, the first withdrawal in 1975, this was the interim agreement. Israel withdrew to about one third of the Sinai. Then, in 1980, Israel redeployed from about two thirds of the Sinai, and then in 1982, Israel redeployed from the entire Sinai, and Egypt regained control of all her territory, piece by piece. And Egypt still controls that territory today. All right, page 225, Operation Peace for Galilee. Early in June 1982, Israel's borders with the neighboring Arab countries were reasonably quiet. The southern frontier with Egypt was altogether in a state of peace. If the West Bank trembled in barely suppressed ferment, infiltration from Jordan, at least, had ended since 1970. To the northeast, Syria remained irredeemably hostile. but not a single episode of truce violation had occurred along the Golan since the 1974 disengagement agreement, not even since Israel's annexation of the critical buffer plateau in December of 1981. Menachem Begin's attention was transfixed, however, by Lebanon, the smallest and weakest of Israel's neighbors. Throughout May and June of 1981, the Israeli Air Force periodically attacked guerrilla positions in Lebanon. Remember, the PLO had moved into Lebanon. Syria had moved into Lebanon. Lebanon was a very weak country. It was being dominated by the PLO and Syria at this point in time. When the guerrillas lashed back with a rocket barrage against Nahariya, a middle-sized northern Israeli town, Air Force jets escalated the level of violence in a heavy retaliatory bombardment of PLO headquarters in Beirut, killing some 100 people and wounding at least 600 others. Now here's a map of Israel, and directly to the north of Israel, that northern border, is the weak little nation of Lebanon. Nahariya, very pretty little town, it just sits just below the border. And because of the attack on Nahariya, this retaliatory attack occurred. The PLO then launched an even more prolonged Katyusha rocketing of Galilee settlements. And here's a picture of a Katyusha rocket. It's a Russian rocket. So these were the rockets that the PLO was shooting from Lebanon into the northern Galilee settlements. The PLO leadership subsequently built their frontline strength in South Lebanon to the equivalent of 5 infantry brigades. That is about 15,000 soldiers. The PLO is now a small army. It's no minor terrorist organization anymore. So this PLO force could increase Katyusha and artillery salvos. It could increase its Fedayeen raids and even attempt amphibious forays against Israel's 63 Galilee settlements and coastal towns. Chief of Staff Eitan, for Chief of Staff Eitan, I should say, the evidence was compelling that only a larger scale military operation could eradicate the danger.
And,
excuse me? A Fedayeen, that is a terrorist fighter. Okay, that is a Arab freedom fighter, terrorist fighter. And here's a picture of the Chief of Staff, General Rafael Eitan. I don't think I'd like to meet him in a dark alley on a rainy night. he looks like a tough character to me. All right. So the catalyst for the invasion was provided from an unexpected sight. June 3rd, 1982, the De La Rogue Group, a British printing and publishing conglomerate, held a banquet in London's Dorchester Hotel. 400 guests included industrialists and several ambassadors. One of the ambassadors was Shlomo Argov of Israel. When the banquet ended, Argov left the hotel shortly before 11 in the evening. A young Palestinian, Hassan Saeed, carrying a shoulder bag, had been loitering on the street outside for nearly an hour. As the ambassador entered his limousine, Saeed removed a submachine gun from the bag. He fired one shot from a distance of 15 feet. Argov was struck in the head and collapsed. He would survive, but he would be paralyzed. The following day, the Israeli Air Force began massive bombardment of PLO targets in Lebanon, battering arms depots and military camps the entire distance up to Beirut. The reaction of individual PLO factions was to launch a sporadic shelling of Israeli settlements in the Galilee. At an emergency cabinet meeting on June 5th, Begin insisted that the army would have to strike immediately to activate a long-prepared strategy of clearing a 25-mile-wide strip along the Lebanese border. If this was accomplished, the PLO's artillery would be pushed decisively beyond range of Israel's northern settlements. Assurance was given that Beirut was not the objective. The Operation Peace for Galilee, would be completed within 2 or 3 days. Page 226. The cabinet then gave its approval. So did Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin of the Labor Party, when they were informed by Begin. June 6, 1982, three Israeli divisions closed in on the Palestinians from all sides. Up the coastal road by amphibious forces landed between Sidon and Damor by a division sent into the central sector through the Shuf Mountains. And the advance was very rapid. Now here I show you a picture of Major Israel Isaac. When I was in Israel for 3 weeks as a volunteer for the Israeli Defense Forces, they would give us volunteers lectures and educational opportunities in the evening. And so Major Israel Isaac was one of the speakers we had one of the evenings. Now you can see Major Isaac has been wounded severely. He was wounded in Lebanon. He lost an eye. His right arm is severely damaged. If I remember right, he had trouble walking. He had braces on his legs, etc. So he spoke to us. He's still an information officer for the IDF. And this is what he informed us. He informed us that this advance into Lebanon was the first time that the PLO had used children in battle. He said it was an incredibly unnerving experience. You'd be driving along in your tank, and up ahead of you, these Lebanese children are waving and saying, hi, hi, hi. As soon as you pass them, they pull out an anti-tank weapon and aim it at the back of your tank. What do you do? Do you allow them to attack your tank and kill you and your friends, or do you kill a child? Do you shoot a child? Can you imagine the emotional dilemma these Israeli soldiers were under as they advanced into Lebanon? This is the first time the PLO had used children in battle, and they're still doing it. They're still doing it. Well, anyway, I appreciated that lecture by Major Isaac. He had tremendous emotional trauma from that as well. Not only physical trauma, but emotional trauma. All right, on the third day, June 8th, Israeli troops were already beyond the 25-mile security zone that had been declared as the objective of Operation Peace for Galilee. On June 7, Israeli troops attacked Syrian units in Jezin, a junction controlling access to the southern Bekaa Valley. It was a costly full-scale battle. Calling up reinforcements, the Syrians launched a heavy counterattack of their own. They inflicted serious casualties on the Israelis, whose armored column was stopped in its tracks. Air supremacy was vital, and no alternative existed but to strike directly against the SAM-6 missiles placed in the valley. Ariel Sharon, the defense minister, argued that bombardment of the missiles was necessary to minimize Israeli casualties in the Lebanese coastal zone. Begin supported the argument. Only after a brief hesitation, the cabinet members approved the attack with the understanding that they had endorsed a major ground operation against a powerful Syrian army. June 9, the Israelis launched their attack. Wave after wave of planes came over. F-16s flying top cover. F-15s. F-16s carrying bombs. A Hawkeye command plane crowded with electronic gear, directing operations and jamming the Syrian radar. The SAMs were launched. They failed to register a single hit. Conversely, 17 of the 19 missile batteries were knocked out by the Israeli bombs. The following day, another wave of Israeli jets finished the job, destroying the remaining batteries. Almost as costly for the Syrians was the beating taken by their own air force. During the first Israeli attack on the missiles, the Syrians came out with their MiG-25 interceptors. And this is the MiG-25 Foxbat. It is no casual interceptor. It is an incredible fighting machine. It is a mean machine. Here's a picture of a MiG-25 Foxbat. This is what came out against the Israeli aircraft.
Is that Russian?
Russian, supplied by Russia, yes. The Israeli aircraft supplied by America, the Syrian aircraft supplied by Russia. The Israelis shot down 22 without a loss. The next day, the second day of the attack, another 24 Syrian jets were destroyed, again without Israeli losses. And by the way, the the MiG-25 could fly higher and faster than the Israeli aircraft.
It was a
formidable enemy. Yeah, who's taking care of Israel here? They didn't lose one. In the ensuing days, nearly 50 additional Syrian fighters would be downed without cost to the Israelis. As early as the night of June 9 and 10, the Israeli Air Force was free to ravage the Syrians on the ground. After these 48 hours of disasters, the Syrians decided to pull out of active fighting altogether. Despite its loss of SAM missiles and ultimately of more than 100 planes, the Assad regime understood that the war was being fought in Lebanon, not in Syria, and that the Israelis were not interested in penetrating Syrian territory. Now, the war suddenly appeared much more far-reaching than the Israeli cabinet or the people had been led to anticipate. And so it did to the great powers as well. In the morning of June 10th, President Reagan dispatched an urgent message to Begin, pointing out that Israel's incursions into Lebanon already far transcended Jerusalem's original announced purpose. Page 227. Israel would have to accede to a ceasefire immediately, the president warned. The prime minister and his cabinet agreed to a ceasefire for noon the next day, June 11. The Israeli government ignored Yasser Arafat's announced willingness to participate in the June 11 truce, observing that his guerrilla force was not a responsible government, but a band of terrorists. Emphasizing the point, Israeli forces on June 12 launched a sustained air, land, and sea bombardment of Palestinian strongholds south and west of Beirut. June 13, several key objectives of Operation Feast for Galilee had been reached. The PLO infrastructure south of Beirut had been destroyed. The Syrians had been soundly thrashed, if not evicted, from Lebanon. They had captured vast quantities of PLO equipment. After inventory was completed in October, the list of PLO material included 1,320 armored combat vehicles, among them several hundred obsolete tanks, 82 artillery pieces, 62 Katyusha rocket launchers, 215 mortars, 196 anti-aircraft guns, 1,342 anti-tank weapons, 33,000 small arms, and thousands of pieces of communications equipment. This was a mini army, wasn't it?
That's a lot of stuff.
It's a mini army. Yep. Jerusalem contended that the destruction of the PLO in South Lebanon was an act of liberation. Now, the claim seemed borne out by local Arab reaction to the Israeli invasion. Foreign journalists confirmed that the inhabitants of South Lebanon were euphoric at the destruction of the Palestinian guerrilla forces because they had been persecuted by the PLO. The PLO were no friends of the Lebanese. Shia Muslims and Christians alike vied with each other in welcoming Israeli troops, inviting Israeli officers into their homes. When the Israeli army detained 9,000 PLO suspects, Christian and Shia villagers eagerly helped the task of identification. Now, the cost to the Palestinians, PLO fighters and non-combatants alike, was quite terrible. Estimates later put the number of Palestinian dead in South Lebanon's refugee camps at over 6,000. Israeli troops who entered these complexes afterward were aghast at the carnage wreaked by the bombardments. They were shocked, too, by the vindictiveness of the Christian and Shia authorities, who refused the Red Cross permission to set up tent shelters for the Palestinian victims. Israel lost 130 dead and 600 wounded. So news of these losses set off widening tremors of concern in Israel. But, you know, no one could anticipate that the worst was yet to come. Now, you have on page 228, you have this map. And the legends in the map will summarize the Operation Peace for Galilee as Israel moves north into Lebanon, up to Beirut there in the northern part of the map. And we move now to Operation Big Pines on page 229. After a week of war, Israel's army was in effective occupation of southern Lebanon. Its tanks and self-propelled guns surrounded Beirut, trapping some 15,000 Palestinian guerrillas intermingled in the western part of the city, among a half million local Muslims. Now it was time for Ariel Sharon to set in motion Operation Big Pines. This was his carefully guarded master plan for smashing the PLO infrastructure in Beirut. In Sharon's scenario, the destruction of the PLO quasi-government in Lebanon would shatter Yasser Arafat's influence among the inhabitants of the West Bank. It was an audacious scheme, one that far transcended the officially proclaimed goal of Operation Peace for Galilee. This is so Ariel Sharon. Very audacious, bold man who would go off on his own. And that's what he had set up here. Now is the moment for the, under the protection of the Israeli air and military power, for the Falangist forces to send their militias directly into West Beirut and complete the rout of the PLO. So I've introduced a new word to you there, Falangist. Falangist forces are the militia of the Lebanese Falange political party. Okay, the Falangist forces are the militia of the Lebanese Falange political party. That's where they come from. They are Lebanese. They are not very strong. They are just a militia. They could never defeat Syria and the PLO. They couldn't protect their country. But with the help of Israel, they could. So they were supposed to go into West Beirut and complete the rout of the PLO. But here the arrangements hung fire. Best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. Despite heavy pressure from Sharon, the Falangist leadership refrained from military action. The Israeli command soon faced a painful decision. Their troops had pushed too far to leave the PLO enclave intact. Yet the notion of moving directly into the city and using troops in bitter street fighting was unacceptable. Accordingly, after a few days of hesitation, General Eitan and his staff came up with an alternative, one that gained cabinet approval. It was to uproot the PLO guerrillas by siege, by a heavy aerial and military bombardment, by halting munitions and food supplies. So for the next 2 months, some 400 Israeli tanks and 1,000 guns poured salvo after salvo into West Beirut. For the first time in the nation's long series of wars against the Arabs, Israel's air force bombed an enemy capital systematically. By the first week of July, some 500 buildings had been destroyed by shells and bombs. In the world's first manhunt by air, and they were hunting down Yasser Arafat, in the world's first manhunt by air, the Israelis also nearly succeeded in killing Arafat. On four different occasions, with information provided by their own spies and local informers, they bombed or rocketed targets less than an hour after Arafat departed. So he missed getting killed four times. Close calls. Four close calls. As Sharon had hoped, the pulverizing siege rapidly became unendurable for the Palestinian guerrillas. In late June, Arafat let it be known that he was prepared to withdraw his men from the city if appropriate terms and guarantees could be worked out. The Israelis rejected all qualifications. Page 230. To intensify the pressure, Israeli troops on August 4th, 1982, took over Beirut's international airport and began inching forward selectively into the western part of the city. The Air Force, meanwhile, carried out its single heaviest bombing of the war, 127 sorties in 10 hours. Simultaneously, naval vessels offshore joined in the bombardment, launching Gabriel missiles into West Beirut. Arafat was completely unnerved by then. But it wasn't Israel's hard stance alone that eroded his confidence. Where would his troops go if he surrendered? Where would his troops go? Not a single Arab country was willing at first to offer the Palestinians sanctuary. On August 12th, Sharon ordered an unprecedented saturation bombing of West Beirut. It continued for nearly a day and it killed 300 people. The August 12th saturation attack inflicted a particularly severe blow on Israel's image in the democratic world. Western newspaper and television reportage gave a sharply biased account of the war, often accepting PLO figures of Lebanese and Palestinian dead and wounded. Things haven't changed at all. Journalists drew analogies between the genocide of Beirut and the genocide of Warsaw in World War II.
Please,
I agree with you. Crazy. Finally, an evacuation of PLO troops was scheduled to begin August 21st, 1982, and end on September 4th. And remarkably, all went according to plan. The PLO troops were hooted and jeered by thousands of Christian Lebanese onlookers. The long years of PLO intimidation and terrorism appeared to be ending. During those 12 days, some 14,000 Palestinian and Syrian fighters were evacuated from the capital, either by sea or overland on the Beirut-Damascus highway. Now, you have this map on page 231. This map summarizes Operation Big Pines. Now, first, I want to show you the important areas of the map. In the circle here, just south of Beirut, you see the Syrian army controlled the area just south of Beirut. North of them is the Falange militia. They only managed to control a small section of their country. Notice the Syrian army dominated most of Lebanon. Lebanon was weak. Syria just kind of took it over. South of the Syrian army, you see the PLO dominating that area down to the border of Israel. And that crosshatch area is the where the Israeli army and their proxies were located. Okay, so that's before Operation Big Pines. Now, after Operation Big Pines, in place of the Syrian army, you have the Druze militia just south of Beirut controlling that area. You see there is significant retreat by the Syrians from parts of Lebanon. Syria still controlled most of Lebanon, but you see a significant retreat due to the Israeli invasion. And then south of the Druze militia, you see Shia militias, Muslim Shia militias, controlling that part of Lebanon, down to the area where the Israelis controlled it. So that is the effect of Operation Big Pines, to try and liberate and to destroy the PLO influence in southern Lebanon and its rocketing and mortars of Israel. So that's the point behind it. The state of Lebanon today, I don't have a map of that, but Lebanon is still a very weak country, and you have Hezbollah now in the south, which is our next subject. Yes?
You said that they evacuated all those troops. Where did they go?
They went into the Arab world. I believe Arafat ended up in Libya. You know, they went into the Arab world. They were dispersed into Syria and other Arab countries. Alrighty, bottom of page 31, you see the words Hezbollah, identity and goals. Well, the next page then is an article on Hezbollah, its identity and goals. So I want you to go ahead and read that on your own. We're not going to... No, the bottom of page 231, it says Hezbollah, bottom of page 231. Okay, so the top of page 232 is the article on Hezbollah. So I want you to read that on your own. Then at the bottom, 1987, the bottom of page 232, you have the heading Hamas founded. And on starting on page 233, you see an article entitled A Guide to Hamas. Now we're very familiar with Hamas, right, these days? Well, this is where it all began. Take a look at the second paragraph there. Hamas, an Arabic acronym. Do you see that? An Arabic acronym for Islamic Resistance Movement, meaning zeal. It was created in Gaza, the Gaza Strip, by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And here is Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Very pleasant looking old man, but he's not very pleasant at all. He is a murderer and a terrorist.
Crazy eyes.
Crazy eyes, yeah. So he is the founder of Hamas that we know so intimately today. So I want you to read page 233. You'll get a quick guide, a quick overview of Hamas. Read that tonight before you go to bed. It'll keep you awake all night. And we'll pick it up. We will pick it up next week on page 234 with the Intifada. You've all heard of the Intifada. Here is the first one. The word Intifada is a Arabic word meaning shaking off. We're going to shake off the Israeli oppressors. That's the idea here. All righty, so let me pray. Yes, question.
Do you remember when was that thing with the Marines and they were...
Oh, the bombing of the Beirut. Yeah, I don't remember when that was, when the military barracks, our military barracks was Beirut, was bombed. 93? Okay, so it's sometime in the future. Okay. Okay, let me pray. Father, again, we just stop and we thank you for your care for Israel. As Isaiah has shared many times in his work, that even in disobedience, you will keep the nation and preserve the nation. And we see your hand was at work in as Israel tried to defend herself from the PLO in Lebanon. But of course, no human plan goes perfectly, and many mistakes and injury was caused by the Israeli incursion. And we know, Lord, that even as Israel tries to defend herself today, she will make mistakes, and she will make cause error and hurt to people, as she is hurt as well. So we ask that you would give the Israeli government wisdom as they try to protect themselves. First of all, that they would look to you for the correct mode of attack and defense, and that you would oversee the situation. So war is always very painful for both sides, and we know that very, very intimately because we have been involved in many Mideast incursions ourselves. Anyway, we lift Israel up to you. We ask that you continue to sustain the nation, turn the nation to yourself and to Yeshua, and give the nation wisdom as they walk day by day through a very, very tough neighborhood. And help the believers in Israel, Arab and Jew alike, to speak up about the Prince of Peace, because we know that no peace will come to the Middle East until the Prince of Peace rules everyone's heart. So we lift ourselves up to you, and we ask you to rule in our heart as well. We do this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week. Take care.